I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm James Wilcock.
And I'm Lizzie Burden. James, it's our first episode together and I'm back from Dubai.
You've come back specially for me.
I have indeed. I'm a professional camel rider now. But also back from a little break is Rishi Sunak, and he's been at the Liaison Committee, which of course is the blockbuster committee. It's got the chairs of the various government select committees all gathered to question him on government policy for just under 2 hours. Just take a listen to him talking about the economy.
Well, when I first got this job, I set out five priorities. Three of them were economic: to halve inflation, grow the economy and reduce debt. And I'm pleased to say we've made progress on all three, particularly on inflation, which was the number one economic objective, to bring it down from the record highs that we've seen at 11%. Obviously, the last set of numbers at just under 3.5% were very encouraging. And in terms of the economy, obviously, we'd all like to see the economy growing faster, but it is worth saying it defied the sceptics last year, significantly outperformed expectations and did in fact grow, and all the signs from early this year are that it has returned to growth, as we saw in the latest GDP figures. And then obviously we are on track to meet our fiscal rules to ensure that debt is falling. So those are the three main priorities I set out. Progress on all three. We've got to stick to the plan. I'm happy to expand in detail as you'd like.
So that was the Prime Minister speaking on his favourite subject there. I thought it was pretty remarkable how relaxed he sounded, James, but he does like to dig into the detail, doesn't he? It's a more comfortable setting than perhaps at Prime Minister's questions or when he's talking to us, the media.
I think it's really fascinating. Over the course of this podcast, I've listened to far more Rishi Sunak than I think I would care to if he were doing any other role but being Prime Minister. It was by far the most calm and controlled he's been with what the messages he wanted to put across and what he wanted to say. He seems to find it far more difficult engaging with Keir Starmer or the media, at least in terms of tone and in terms of policy. And I found it really fascinating that in some ways that was his element. And I wonder how his team will be thinking about how to bring that kind of spirit out of him when he gets on the campaign trail, which is something, if you talk to Tory party strategists, they always say it's like the big fear they have is what happens when the campaign happens, because Rishi Sunak has never fought an election campaign as Prime Minister before.
Nor did he have to win that leadership battle against Liz Truss in order to get to number 10, even though they had the competition and she won. But look, either way, some news that the Prime Minister might not have found so relaxing was the resignation of two more ministers, which has forced a mini reshuffle yesterday evening.
Yes, I mean, the departures of Education Minister Robert Halfen and Armed Forces Minister James Heapy take the total number of Tory MPs not contesting the next election to 63. That's nearly a fifth of those who were elected to the party in 2019 as MPs. Well, joining us now to discuss this conservative exodus is Bloomberg's associate editor Alva Ray. Alva, you followed these two ministers and their careers for quite some time. Can you tell us a bit about Robert Halfen and James Heapy and why their exits are causing a bit of a stir in the party?
So I think that part of the reason, which I shouldn't gloss over, is actually that it's just a quite quiet news day. And so across Westminster, so all the MPs have just gone off for Easter recess. Nothing's really happening in politics. We're not getting big announcements from Rishi Sunak or from the Labour Party, really. And then it means that this story is the one that has kind of risen to the surface while we all still need to be covering politics. Otherwise, it maybe wouldn't be getting so much oxygen. But I think it means that we actually have a little bit of space to look at this trend that's been going on for months, which is, as you say, dozens of Tory MPs have announced that they are not standing again at the next election, and probably many more will follow before we actually have that poll towards the end of the year. I think that these two that you mentioned are interesting, really, because they are also ministers. So they haven't flounced off in a huff or anything. It's just because they've already announced that they won't stand again at the next election, so it doesn't make sense for them to stay on as ministers. But then that means that Rishi Sunak has to reshuffle them and replace them. Probably part of the motivating factor, as well as expecting to lose their seats, is that if they are standing down, it's better to do it at this point because of the rules around getting a job after government. So they've been ministers, which makes them different to other MPs who are announcing that they're standing down. It means that if at this point they've stood down, they have 6 months before they then go off to some nice job in the private sector, which means that they will be within the rules. So really, I think there might be a little bit of an eye on the next job.
And it's worth saying, I mean, these aren't kind of Lee Anderson style renegades for the party, are they? These are like people who've been very low maintenance for Rishi Sunak, not causing sort of big issues as ministers.
Yeah, I think you would have seen there was quite a nice tribute to James Heapy, the outgoing armed forces minister, from Labour's shadow defence secretary yesterday. I think he's quite highly regarded, seen as very sensible, as you say, but I think will probably still be making quite a strong case from the backbenches for increased defence spending, which won't be completely comfortable for Rishi Sunak.
Yeah, to me, it's really obvious why you would stand down as a Tory MP if you were looking at the polls right now. I kind of wonder why you would stay.
So I think part of it is maybe some of them just want to hang on. Also, if you contest the next election, I'm pretty sure this is correct, you get effectively redundancy pay. Oh. So if you stand and lose, you get more of a payout than if you don't, even though that might restrict your how quickly you can get another job, basically.
I believe that pay, it was recently increased by the Conservatives from £3,000 to £17,000. So it's a sizable amount if you do contest.
It is. Yeah. But yes, I mean, some, I think, probably just want to get their ducks in a row and sort of announcing that they are standing down, winding down that work means that they can put a bit more effort into looking for their next job, because some have announced it with quite a lot of notice. But I think Robert Halfen, just since you were asking for a bit more context, I think also people are covering this a bit more just because he's so well liked around Westminster. He's a rare MP with a disability. He's been a really big campaigner for education. He's sort of seen as a figurehead for blue-collar conservatism. And he's just well-liked around the House of Commons. So I think that him announcing his resignation has come as a bit of a genuine surprise, and it's been a bit bittersweet, really, for even just the journalists who know him. I mean, you're seeing on Twitter sort of tributes to him that you don't often see from journalists from The Sun, like across the whole sweep of publications. So I think that's another reason, I think, why people are interested in this.
And I think it's worth saying, it is a quiet week, and this is all because we're building up to the May elections. Oh, the word you see a lot in the media right now around Rishi Sunak is danger. Is this just us journalists trying to find something to talk about, or are these exits, this kind of discontent building the party, actually building to a serious sense of some sort of moment of danger for Rishi Sunak?
I think this is the calm before the storm, in that May the 2nd, when these local elections and mayoral elections and by-election will be held, are unlikely to go well for the Conservatives, because the council seats that are being contested were last contested in May 2021. If you remember, that was a point when Boris Johnson and the Conservatives were riding high. Labour could not touch them. Boris Johnson was riding that vaccine bounce. He won that by-election in Hartlepool, but with a really, really strong majority. That was sort of the Boris Johnson high point. Mm. So when you think of all of the Conservative councillors who were elected then, just coming back to sort of even just a more normal point in sort of midterm for a government, you would almost expect them to be losing some seats. Mm. So given that the Conservatives are trailing so badly now, I think that could look very, very bad. That could be carnage, really. Everyone's really just waiting for that. Everyone will be campaigning in the next few weeks. But I think that when that happens, Rishi Sunak could be in real danger.
Mm. All right, Bloomberg's associate editor, Alva Ray, thank you for that analysis. James, I've wanted to say this forever. It seems it's half on, half off.
I mean, look, let's wait and see for those results. It, like Alva says, carnage is the word it could be. And then the question there is quite how many Conservative MPs want to put up with carnage for any bit longer. Now, from people who are ending their journeys in Westminster to someone who's just beginning theirs, Carmen Smith is the newest and youngest member of the House of Lords. The Plaid Cymru activist is only 28, making her 43 years younger than the average peer. She joins us now. Carmen, simply... why?
Well, you know, wherever decisions are made, we've got to have voices there that are going to stand up for people.
And what is the attention been like since you were announced as a new peer and the youngest peer as well?
No, I think that there's been some, you know, good, positive attention just in terms of also, you know, just in terms of my age and in terms of, and in response to that, I can talk on issues that, you know, my generation cares about. So, yeah, I'm just looking forward to getting stuck in. There's a job of work to do.
Carmen, there's a bit of an irony here. You want the Lords to be abolished. What's so wrong with the Lords in your opinion, and what would you replace it with?
Yes, so the House of Lords is, well, one of the biggest unelected chambers in the world. And I don't believe in any unelected chamber. You know, I'm a Democrat and believe that, you know, where decisions are made, it should be made by people that are representative of society. So, I mean, for that reason alone, I don't believe in the Lords.
Well, I mean... you want to be part of where the decisions are, but, I mean, is it worth taking a moral stance? Would you give back the salary, say?
I think it's important that, like I said, where decisions are made, you've got to have voices there. And I think you mentioned before, so the average age of the House of Lords is 71, and it's a chamber of 70% men. It's also often the appointments are made on the basis of people being big donors to political parties and, you know, the friends of party leaders. I'm certainly not, I don't fit in either of those camps. And I'm hoping to, you know, just be, you know, go in there with a fresh perspective, but also to be honest and stand up for things that, you know, people care about. We're in a cost of living crisis. And yeah, so I just want to do a good job and represent people well.
So, Carmen, I have to come clean. This is a slightly horrifying interview for me because we are the same age.
I mean, how do you think I feel, James? I'm even older.
So, I do want to ask you, though, you talk to young people, people our age, and you hear renting, jobs, the cost of living you've already brought up, university debt for people our age who've gone, or if people who haven't gone, sort of being stuck at home in sort of the town of their parents. So many people, according to polls, seem to say that young people have a sort of sense of hopelessness about the system. You now find yourself at the top of that political system. So I want to ask you, why do you think young people should engage with a system that seems not to be working for them?
I completely agree with everything you've just said there. And honestly, this isn't as good as it gets. We need to have, for one, more young voices in politics to be able to call out this inaction by governments in terms of, yeah, why are we just, you know, sitting watching, you know, rent soaring and, you know, bills soaring, unstable job market? This isn't as good as it gets, is it? And I think we need to hold and scrutinize the government more and be able to, you know, tell them in terms of, you know, from our generation, in terms of what we aspire our nation to be.
How do you do that, and how do you get your peers to listen to you when some might argue that you don't have as much experience as them?
Well, I think, first of all, I am just one person and I want to bring in more voices into politics from different backgrounds that often aren't heard or represented in those rooms. So that's one thing I hope to do. I can't, you know, I won't be able to do this on my own, and I'm not on my own. You know, there's a movement of people that want to be able to, you know, challenge the system. And, you know, I want to support those people to come in. And then in terms of, yeah, so I will be active raising these issues every day, and hopefully that will make a difference. But you know, we've got to have more young voices in politics to begin with.
You were just talking about this sort of movement. Just before you were speaking about some people leaving politics, and it's worth saying there are two women who entered Parliament in their 20s in 2019, Mari Black from the SNP, Dehenna Davidson from the Conservatives, who became really high-profile senior figures. After 5 years, they're both quitting. One site struggles with migraines, the other one calls Parliament, quote, one of the most unhealthy workplaces you could ever be in. Do you think the political system doesn't sort of help encourage young people and young women if it sort of has these results like that?
Definitely. And I consider myself, you know, lucky to be in this position, but I'm also in this position because I want to change those systems and make politics a better place for others. I mean, just in terms of the way it's designed,
how do we do that, though?
Well, it's just even in terms of the sitting time. So, I mean, in the Lords, they often sit at maybe 2:30 until around 10 p.m. or midnight. And that's not an appropriate schedule, really, for many people, in terms of especially those with perhaps young families. But, you know, I'm specifically talking about the Lords there, but that is often the same case in the other parliaments as well, across the UK, and you know, well, in the Commons as well in Westminster. And just the way that the system is designed just, you know, is it doesn't work for lots of people. But we need to make politics work better for people so that it's more representative. And you know, I'll be speaking on those matters.
Okay, so that's the House of Lords as a workplace, but let's focus in on your politics. Do you think your generation is going to vote for an independent Wales?
My generation are increasingly in favour of independence. But independence is a journey. You know, you don't become an independent nation overnight. But in terms of what kind of drives my belief of independence is that ultimately Westminster isn't working for Wales. It doesn't prioritise the people of Wales or our the things that we care about. In terms of how we're funded, the formula used for funding services in Wales is basically enough to survive but not thrive. There's no investment. You know, poverty is just increasing and the amount of people going to food banks is increasing, and that is just not good enough, and people deserve, you know, a more hopeful future. And in terms of independence, you know, it isn't an easy path, but then if we had certain levers in our control, like fiscal levers, you know, we'd have more autonomy in terms of what we do as a grow as a nation. And that's what really excites me.
So, I mean, just fiscal levers is worth pointing out, like an argument for, say, devolution rather than full independence. And it kind of speaks to what I was about to ask you, Carmen, which is, you know, you've worked your way into a system that doesn't reflect you being 28, and you want to change it from within. You've said all these things about trying to change it. Yet the independence movement is almost trying to sort of opt out of the system. It sort of seems to clash with your personal brand of politics. How do you sort of square those two?
I think that they are separate things is what I mean is, you know, in terms of, like I was saying there, in terms of reforming politics, of course I think politics should be reformed. And then ultimately I believe in an independent Wales where we probably wouldn't have a second chamber, and we'd have more perhaps citizens' assemblies in a modern democracy. And then England might still need to have a second chamber, but if it does, it still does need reforming, but then it would be up for the people of England in terms of what that looks like. But you know, I think you can agree that in terms of the design of Westminster is that it's so dated and it just doesn't have a place in modern democracy.
I'm curious, you know, young people historically sort of drive change in a lot of politics in this world that faces these kind of global challenges, climate change, war, the sort of the future of democracy. How does independence play into that? Like, why is making Wales an independent player on the global stage the sort of goal you want to achieve in politics?
I see an independent Wales being quite a big player in the international community, part of that community in terms of being an open society and contributing towards, you know, some of the global challenges in terms of tackling climate change and making that contribution, but making that contribution as an independent country.
Okay, Carmen Smith, the new youngest member of the House of Lords. Congratulations and thanks for joining us on the Bloomberg UK Politics podcast. James, I thought that was really interesting and depressing. Carmen, younger than me, same age as you, but really very optimistic about how much change she can impact from the House of Lords, and a unique voice. It speaks to diversity in our political system.
Well, if you're in the mood for sort of new young talent to sort of compare yourself to, Lizzie, Keir Mather, the sort of Labour MP who made waves after being elected, I think he's 25, has just got a job in the Labour Whip's office. So not only are there Lords younger than you, there are also front benchers younger than you.
Rub it in, why don't you? He's a busy man, isn't he? He's also on the Treasury Select Committee. And so he's got his opinions there on fiscal policy. He will have been busy around the budget. And of course, he's had the chance recently to question both the Chancellor and the Governor of the Bank of England.
I think the interesting things here, though, is as well as people leaving politics, that will give space for new people. And the question is, they don't all have to be young. I mean, tomorrow's MPs are sort of the Twitter account on X has been tracking quite a few of them. And it is fascinating to watch which demographics are being sort of selected to be MPs. And it is increasingly sort of looking like certain demographics are being left out. I mean, Labour seem to have a real issue with young black men who are running stand. Mm-hmm. And it's this question of, does your MP need to represent you in terms of their diversity or in terms of their, what their policies are?
And you can't represent everybody by matching yourself to them demographically.
Mm. And this question of like how far will the Conservatives be able to sort of match gender? We talked about Theresa May a few weeks ago on the podcast and where it leaves kind of the UK and the Conservatives on moving towards gender parity. It will be an interesting question to see when the final kind of selection numbers are out, how the sort of slots of MPs and MP candidates compare to sort of where the parties want to position themselves on issues like diversity.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you mentioned Mari Black as an example. Yes, it's inspiring when you have young members of parliament, whether in the Commons or in the Lords, but are they just a flash in the pan? Is this just a temporary moment in politics? It's different for Carmen because she's in the Lords, of course, but are we going to see this influx of young MPs around this election that's such a pivotal moment in politics, and then can it actually continue for decades to come?
I mean, it also, in terms of sort of talent and people getting new opportunities, for a lot of the shadow cabinet, one of the big fears for Labour is they haven't yet done big government jobs as the cabinet rather than the shadow cabinet if they were to win the polling. And it's one of those things where you often ask sort of Labour Party strategists, oh, who do you think is good? Who do you think would be sort of worth interviewing? Who do you think would sort of be worth getting on the podcast, for example? And many of them are lined up to come, Lizzie. But the question they often put back is, well, so-and-so may be a good media performer, but we don't yet know if they would be a good minister. Who handles the brief well? Who is actually good at talking to the press? Who can engage with business? Who is good at sort of talking to voters? A lot of these questions you only find out when they're tested. Election campaigns are often the biggest test.
Well, it's one thing to have no political experience. It's another thing to have very little experience outside of politics to then qualify you to be in a ministerial role. You see lots of people at the Treasury, Gareth Davis is a good example, who have worked in the city for many years before entering a ministerial role. Sajid Javid likewise had a long career in the city before he became Chancellor. And so have they got the metal? Have they got the minerals to take on this sort of brief?
I mean, Rachel Reeves, famously a former BOE economist.
Well, has she told us that before, James? Has she reminded us of that fact?
I wouldn't happen to have heard it, Lizzie. Maybe you've heard it.
Well, that's all we've got time for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo. Our audio engineers were Marufal Hussain and Sean Guastamacchia. I'm James Wilcock.
And I'm Lizzie Burden. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, data-powered transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.